7.5 FM, W298DK Amory, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Chuck Sievertson. Two Twisters touched down in Portage, Michigan tonight, south of Grand Rapids and Kalamazoo. They're finding heavy destruction. One damaged house is on top of a smashed car. Thousands without power. After last night's tornadoes hit Oklahoma, in Barnstall today, Governor Kevin Stitt.
We just toured the damage here, probably 60, 70 homes that were totally destroyed, and I think the count's up to probably 350 or so statewide now.
The Biden administration has delayed delivery of ammunition to Israel, say three U.S. officials to ABC News. The U.S. opposes Israel's plans for a ground invasion of southern Gaza. The Justice Department's contacted families of victims of two fatal Boeing 737 MAX crashes, inviting them to a meeting about possible liability, according to a letter gotten by ABC News. The man who pulled a gun on a pastor at a Western Pennsylvania church Sunday, charged with homicide. His cousin was found shot dead. This is ABC News. The crew that has been stuck on the Dolly cargo ship since it crashed into the Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore in March will stay on board. That's even as demolition crews get ready to use explosives to break down the largest remaining span of collapsed bridge. Controlled demolition expected in the coming days. Looking to turn sales around, Apple rolls out its newest updates.
The last time Apple updated the iPad was all the way back in 2022, but at the company's first event of the year Tuesday.
This is the biggest day for iPad since its introduction.
Apple CEO Tim Cook showing off a new iPad Pro, the high-end tablet in Apple's lineup that now comes with an OLED screen and Apple's latest M4 processor. It's also just 5.1 millimeters thick, which makes it the thinnest Apple product ever, according to the company. Mike Dubusky, ABC News.
The WNBA finally plans to implement full-time charter flights this season. Chuck Sievertson, ABC News.
Fabulous Farm Bay, Pam Yonke here, bringing you the Midwest Farm Report live weekday mornings on WLAK. This isn't just for farmers, people. It's for anybody that enjoys food. Tune in 5 a.m. on Lake Air 1260 WLAK Amory.
Busted Pencils, fully leaded education talk.
When you have a fully funded, privatized voucher system, Heather, help us out.
Wisconsin has made a choice to disinvest from the public good and put money into a wholly unaccountable system and just let their political cronies laugh all the way to the bank while our kids pay the price.
Busted Pencils with Dr. Tim and Dr. Johnny. Weeknights at 6 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
You are listening to your local Civic Media radio station on air. Thank you. Did you know we are always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app too? And if you miss a show or game, find it wherever you get your podcasts or on our website, civicmedia.us.
Hey, on the big program, lots to get to. Lots to talk about. The New York Times reported for the first time in the history of America, for the first time in the history of this great country, our billionaire class has paid a lower effective tax rate than working class Americans. That's right. We've done it. We have created the biggest, strongest, most welfare queen billionaire class in the history of civilization. Pat on the back. I mean, really, we should take, I don't know, some credit for it. Because after all, it is our sacrifice. It is us tightening the belt. It is, two incomes, three incomes now to support a family. It's all of these things that past generations would have never stood for. But we as Americans today, we've done it. We have we've given them everything they could want. And now I'm waiting for it because, you know, is this far enough? Have we given them enough to where it starts to trickle down? I'm asking this seriously because we were told all along, you know, we didn't give enough tax cuts for it to work. We got to do more. We need more tax cuts. Every Republican administration ever is tax cuts, tax cuts, tax cuts. We need tax cuts. Because eventually, if we do it enough, if we give them enough, their pockets will fill and they will then overflow. Rivers of gold and honey, manna from heaven, all that stuff. But I don't see it. Now, here's the thing. This is where you're talking about a political revolution. pulled off by really rich people. Because as the Times points out, you know, in the 1960s, our heavy 400, the wealthiest 400 people in this country, paid more than half of their income in taxes, had much, much higher tax rates. And those higher tax rates, and I've been saying this for a long time, so regular listeners, you won't be shocked, but that kept inequality in check. It was that leveling feature, it was that balance. Strong labor unions, high taxes on rich people. We do what we need to get done. And in the process, what we did as a society, as a prosperous working class, it says, hey, we want to have a safety net. So we created things like Medicare and Medicaid and food stamps so that working people wouldn't fall through the cracks. So what do we have now? Well, we've got the super rich who control a greater share of America's wealth. In fact, more than they did during the Gilded Age of the Rockefellers and the Carnegies. And they still want more. Because understand, the wealth class doesn't pay taxes anymore because of how we've rigged the game. The New York Times points out in 2018, America's top billionaires paid just 23% of their income in taxes, which is lower than the working class. We got to admit it, folks. Our tax system's rigged. It's been gamed. It's not broken. It's working exactly as it was supposed to. It's rigged. Think about corporate taxes. During the 1960s, corporate taxes were 52%. That top marginal tax rate of the Eisenhower era, 92%. And then in comes the Reagan Revolution. Yeah. And they dropped those corporate taxes from 52 down to 34. Trump comes in, he drops it down to 21. Those are permanent. So again, billionaires have rigged the system. And somehow we're surprised when we hear news that, well, the institutions that were the bedrock of a strong working class, of a prosperous working class, things like Social Security, have now blown up. Social Security and Medicare are now in trouble. The Washington Post reported Social Security and Medicare are going to run out of money in just over a decade. Social Security, they say, will be insolvent by 2035. Doesn't mean it's all gone. It means they're going to have to make cuts. And you'll get about 75% of what you're supposed to get because, well, Republicans aren't going to do anything. And Medicare is going to go belly up, they say, 2036. Going to force benefit cuts and drastic ones, painful ones for working people. And Republicans are okay with this. They want it. In fact, you know, you listen to the reporting coming out of the Republican Study Committee. You know, 80% of House Republicans, every Republican leader, they want extreme, deep cuts. Things that Donald Trump has pushed for. MAGA Mike Johnson, the Speaker, former member and chair of the Republican Study Committee. In their proposals, it's all about slash and burn your Social Security and Medicare. You know, your entitlement. Not that thing you worked your whole life for, that date they put down the road where you're going, hey, I might make it. No, they want to push that off. Trump himself said there's a lot you can do to cut Social Security and Medicare. And if you look at every budget that Trump came out with during his 4 years, every one, it's all about cutting Medicare and Social Security. Trump's got a record to run on. And when you put Trump's record next to Biden's record, Biden's trying to save it. And this is where if we had a functional electorate, because I looked at one of the latest Fox News polls, 71% of the Fox News poll chose funding Social Security and Medicare over budget cuts. Axios had a poll. Nearly 90%, 9 in 10 Americans, said they oppose reduced spending on Social Security and Medicare. It's important. And the sad reality is we're living off of the institutions that past generations built. We're living off of what our grandparents fought and bled for. Now, I was thinking about this the other day. What is it over the last 50 years that we've done as a society, as a country? What's been our call to arms? What's been our our mission as a country. I know, go shopping. You know, during the Bush years, it was all about going shopping. You know, it's all about consuming. One with the most toys when they die wins. Greed is good. Yeah, yeah, we've heard it all. But what kind of a future are we going to have if we continue down this path of allowing the Republicans to do what they do best, which is feed the billionaire class more, feed corporate America more? We need a strong labor movement. We need a vibrant labor movement. We need working people to understand that the boss isn't necessarily your buddy, that you have different interests. Now, I've had people tell me that the employer and the employee, that there isn't daylight between their interests. And I find that, well, just ludicrous, because they want to make profit. You're not there because they like you. And you're not there because you like them. You're trying to make a living. You're trying to put a food on the table. And the reality is the working class of this country has been under assault for, the last 50 years at least. The high point of the American economy was 1973. And from that point forward, we've seen inflation. We've seen corporate consolidation. We've seen right-wing media dominate the landscape. All to tell us, each of us are the problem. We're greedy. We want Social Security. We want Medicare when we get old. We want a safety net. You know, we've got an opportunity. And look, I look at what Biden's talking about and ensuring that, you know, maybe we go a different direction. Because Republicans have told us what their tool is, how they're going to fix Social Security. And it's simple. They're going to kill it. Because in order to fix it, you have to kill it. Which means a lot of people are going to suffer and struggle. A lot of people are going to be broke. And a lot of people are going to work to the day that they die. And that's just fine and dandy with them. Because look, they've already said they want to raise the retirement age from 67 for my generation to 70 and beyond. There's one guy who said, well, you know, people want to work into their 80s. And look, if they want to, that's great. If they're able to, fabulous. But the majority of people I know do actual physical manual labor work. Sorry. You're not on your hands and knees. You're not crawling around in a trailer. You're not loading heavy boxes at 70, 80 years old. I'd love to. I'm hoping I'm that spry. But the reality is most people are struggling. Most people are breaking down. And oh, by the way, we do want the next generation to have jobs. So the question I keep coming back to is, what good is an economy if it doesn't benefit working people? Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, Rick at therickSmithShow.com. Going to take a quick break. Right back after this.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So the flight attendants at American Airlines, they are fighting for dignity and respect, and that fight continues. It's been like, I think they're actually working under wages and conditions and all that were negotiated in 2014, and by my that's a decade ago. It seems like time for an update. And, you know, we've had folks come on and talk about this fight. In fact, you may remember back in November of 23, we had folks on from the union talking about, hey, we want to be released so we can go on strike because evidently things aren't moving. And then, you know, January, this past January, we had folks on again talking about a second request for release from mediation. And it appears, well, it appears from the outside at least, things are moving at a glacial pace. And while no one really wants to strike, sometimes it's really the only thing that can jumpstart some sort of urgency. And here to get us up to date on what's going on at American Airlines, I've asked Julie Hedrick to come talk with us. Julie is the national president of the Association of Professional Flight Attendants, APFA.org, their website. Her union represents 27,000 flight attendants at American Airlines. Julie, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you so much for having me on today. I really appreciate the opportunity here to let everyone know what's going on here at American Airlines.
So am I getting this right? The wages that your flight attendants are working under right now were negotiated a decade ago?
Absolutely. That's correct. And I will tell you, we had a state of the airline a couple of weeks ago, and I asked, probably there were about 1,000 company people there, asked all of them, please raise your hand if you haven't had a raise in 5 years. And guess what? The only employees in that group to raise their hand were the flight attendants. Everybody else at this company has had raises. And here are the flight attendants who, especially during COVID, put our lives on the line. We were out flying while they were all home working remote. And we're still struggling to get our CEO to come to the table and to actually pay us what we deserve. They've been more than willing to, we'll do a short-term deal, or, oh, we'll do this. They want the pressure off of them right now. And we've been putting pressure on them for a while. Our members have been doing a great job. We have our 9th picket this week, and we will be, there will be some of us who are in front of the White House picketing this week, because at this point, we need the National Mediation Board to realize that this company needs pressure on them, and that pressure is the pressure of a strike in order to get this done.
Yeah, because as I said, you know, sometimes no one wants to do it. I can't imagine any of your members are excited and want to do it, but sometimes you're backed into a corner, and I would think, you know, I got to be honest, 5 years of negotiation, or however long you've been doing this, and all the mediation, months and months of meetings, and, you know, no real movement. It seems like, well, it seems like, one to me, it's about union busting and making people fed up and wanting to run away. But it seems like also just greed.
Corporate greed at its finest, to say the least. I will say this, that our flight attendants have done a great job showing up. They are ready to strike. We definitely told the CEO that at that last meeting we had in front of everybody. And I have flight attendants who at this point, because they are so frustrated with how long this has taken, that they're like, come on, we just want this to happen now. And I'm trying to keep them from doing it illegally, right? We've got to do it legally. So it's getting more and more difficult as time goes by.
Right. So how many times do you have to ask, though? I mean, back in November of 23, you asked for a release. I guess you got another response of, hey, let's have another cooling off period, more negotiations, all that. January, you come back, still nothing?
So we met with the National Mediation Board in March, and we got to meet with them face-to-face, which was a really great meeting, to say the least. They gave us direction, they gave the company direction, and we're right now in the middle of 3 weeks of negotiations. Now, I can tell you this, the stumbling block that we're at right now is our CEO has been telling everyone they have an economic framework for negotiations, and they will match the highest in the industry. He's been saying this for months to all of us. So we have a new industry standard now. Southwest flight attendants got an industry leading contract a couple weeks ago. And we're like, great, we have our new industry standard. Here we go. And next day, he's out telling everyone on the earnings call that, nope, we're not going to pay him, you know, what Southwest has. We will pay him what Delta has, which is now not the highest in the industry. So new fight all of a sudden, because we have been definitely discussing and Southwest has been part of our comparators for the last year. And that was news to us. But we also at that time, after his the report came out about his earnings of $31 million for last year, realized in the proxy statement, it also says that Southwest is one of his comparators for his salary. So we made sure to point that out to him, that it's not just Delta and United, that Southwest is also for his salary a comparator. So it definitely should be for the flight attendants.
Yeah, so he can get $31 million, but your flight attendants don't get paid while people board. Got it. Or at least I think I got it.
You got it. That's exactly right. Our new hire flight attendants make $27,000 a year. And have to be based in, you know, really expensive cities across this country. You got to be based in New York, Boston, Miami, you know, L.A., everywhere. It's not $27,000 doesn't make it anymore. That doesn't even pay the rent.
I can't even remember when $27,000 did make it, to be honest with you. It was more than a decade ago, I'll be honest with you there. But I was looking at some of the other contract proposals and some of the things that you're asking for, which don't seem unreasonable, given the fact that we've lived through a period of inflation where things are higher. And when you're talking about flight attendants, they're living on the roads. As someone who's a truck driver, I get that living on the road. The cost of meals has gone up. The cost of just existing on the road has gone crazy. So asking for a bit more in areas like per diems and stuff don't seem unreasonable to me.
They haven't even addressed per diem in their proposals back to us. No increase for per diem. And we're like, hold on a second here. You know, first and foremost, we're just like the pilots. We're out on the road as much as they are. Per diem should be the same for both of us. You know, we're in London or Paris or anywhere across the country. And, you know, the price of food costs the same for the flight attendants as it does for the pilots. Yet they haven't been willing to increase our per diem. They are, at this point, it's the negotiations as far as the delay. It is harming our flight attendants terribly. And I can tell you, a lot of them are having to make a really tough decision to leave because they want to do this job, but they just can't afford it.
Yeah, no, it's crazy. But hey, you know, I'm sorry, we $31 million a year in salary. I can't give you a little extra in your per diem because, you know, kids need a little extra Whopper, a little extra cheese on their Whopper. But also something I caught in the deadheading part of your contract, which just means moving people around when they're not working. You guys are asking for, hey, you know, we want the best available seat for our person to be at least comfortable as they're flying around, as where their language is, well, it will give you something like economy plus or something. But if it's not available, you go back.
Yeah. No, we have been, especially in our flights that are over 4 hours, right? That's where we're really pushing to get a better seat. You know, if we're deadheading back from especially Europe, right? And we're on a long flight. It's the least they can do. It is something that we see whenever we do negotiations. Also, we use, you know, the other airline contracts out there for flight attendants. And we see that in their contracts. And we're like, it doesn't make sense that American doesn't realize, you know, that that is something that our flight attendants want. And also that it's not that much to ask for.
No, it doesn't. Again, you know, I don't know the numbers, but if the seat's available, wouldn't you want to just be decent? I mean, this isn't even about, you know, rewarding people. It's just being decent to your employees. It sounds like they don't want anything that looks like a victory. And again, I come back to, maybe it's just what's in my mind, but it sounds like union busting to me at every frame when you could be decent and it cost you nothing, but you choose not to be. That to me is a problem.
I would say this, a lot of this comes down to, especially when it's deadheading, is they want to keep that seat open for as long as they can to get the extra money that possibly you might want to upgrade your seat, you know, at the last minute. So they want you to have that rather than us. That's really what it comes down to. It's, you know, I've worked in the airline industry a very long time. And I will tell you what I see today, I've never seen before. I've worked with, there's been a lot of CEOs over my many years. This is a very, very different type of negotiations and a very different look at the flight attendants. I mean, we've gone, you know, if you go way back in time, flight attendants have always had to fight for their rights, right? And so we're very used to this. And I will tell you, we've got a great group of junior flight attendants. I'm going to say my 9 and 10 year flight attendants are probably our most engaged today. They're the ones who are out there making sure they show up at every picket. And I'm so proud of all the flight attendants, but I'm really so proud to see our junior flight attendants who we were concerned about. Many of them have never had union jobs before. And they have taken this on and they're doing a great job. So we're preparing them for the future. Because as I say to them all the time, every contract, this is what it takes. It's a fight. Now, 5 years is excessive. And some of that is because of COVID. We took about a year and a half pause during COVID because it was just not the right time to be negotiating. But we have looked back at the history of American Airlines and our negotiations. And for the past 40 years, every Section 6 contract we have gotten has come with a release. So we've told that to the NMB, in order for us to get this done, we're going to need them to release us.
I got to tell you, what's frustrating is, we went through the pandemic and, your flight attendants were labeled heroes and essential and all that stuff. And, workers across the board, and we're seeing this in industry after industry. And I don't know what's changed and has made the CEO class seem even more dug in on, no, we're not giving you dignity or respect. But it seems like it's getting worse. Do you have any thoughts on, as you said, it's gotten worse throughout your career, why that's gotten worse? The company's making money, as I've seen. They're making enough money to pay the CEO $31 million. It seems like they could pay the people who actually are out there earning that money for the company. They could treat them with a little bit of dignity and respect.
I agree 100%. There is this thing called A4A. Have you ever heard of it? Airlines for America. For us in the industry, we know this is like a union for CEOs. So all of our CEOs belong to it. It's pretty clear sometimes that they're all working together, trying to keep our wages down. And we're really happy that the Southwest CEO, even though he's part of A4A, he broke out of the model there and gave his flight attendants what they deserve, a great contract. And they overwhelmingly passed it. That is what our CEO needs to realize. And unfortunately, I would say we're also not just American is in negotiations, but also United has been in for quite a while, and as well as Alaska. So we're all still fighting to get there, but they're all working together. They want to keep our wages down as long as they possibly can and devalue our jobs.
Yeah, no, as you were talking a minute ago, the CEO of American said, he would basically sign on a Me Too agreement to the, the company that set the standard. Instead of wanting to be the leader to the top, it sounds like he wants to be the leader to the bottom. And good on you guys for standing up and fighting back. So the last question I've got for you is, how do we help and how do we push in a direction that ensures you don't have to go on strike? Because again, I don't think anybody really wants to. Sometimes you have to. It's the last arrow in the quiver. But what do we do? How can we help?
Well, listen, right now we have our employees as well as our supporters are reaching out to Congress. We have a letter that we are trying to get all of them to sign onto. And currently we have about 60 Congress members that have signed on. And it's a letter to the National Mediation Board, basically telling them to let us exercise our right to strike. In the last 20 some years, they have only released 2 airlines from negotiations and very small airlines. So this letter is really important. We have all of our flight attendants and flight attendants from other unions also calling Congress and asking them to please sign on to this letter. And then that we'll be sending that over to the NMB. And so that would be a big help.
And just because you get the release doesn't mean you're actually going to strike, right?
100%. The release is really what we need for the pressure. We want a contract. I think everybody should know. The flight attendants really want a contract. We don't want to go on strike. We know everyone has plans for, vacations and work, and we need to get them there. And that is our job, and we love doing it. But, we need that pressure on our company in order for us to get this contract done. So, the company, when you think about it, in the last 20 years, if only 2 airlines have been released, these companies all know they're not going to get released. You know, they can drag these out for as long as they want to. And, you know, 5 years without a raise, our flight attendants are really suffering.
It's a bit excessive.
It's not something that can go on any longer.
It's important you get that arrow back in your quiver and at least at the table have the threat of a strike that you're both on the same, at least somewhat on the same footing. But, Julie, I appreciate the time. Anything we can do to help, please let me know. Folks will check out your website, APFA.org. We'll get links out on social media how you can join in on the fight. But, Julie Hedrick, I appreciate the time.
Thank you so much for having me on today.
National president of the Association of Professional Flight Attendants. Her union represents 27,000 plus flight attendants at American. Again, APFA.org, the website, if you want to take a look at what they're doing. Back after this. Stick around.
You're listening to Lake Air 1260 AM WLAK.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Isolated evening storms, then mostly cloudy overnight, with lows in the upper 40s. A mixture of sunshine and clouds for tomorrow, but a couple of showers could pop up in the afternoon. High, low 70s. On Thursday, mostly cloudy and again a slight shower chance. Cooler, highs in the low 60s. Right now it's 58.
The Todd Albaugh Show.
Terry Barr, host of Slice of Wisconsin here on Civic Media. Mr. Zommers, what is that called?
My Wife is Drunk by Terry's favorite, Alvin Stasinski.
There you go.
Yeah, it's so funny to listen to a polka because you think, where did that song come from?
Right? We actually had one person text during the break there said, how about the Meadow Muffin Polka?
Todd, let's quickly write that and make it.
The Todd Albaugh Show. Weekdays, noon till 2 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, last week, the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative, the USTR, held 2 days of public hearings, 8 hours each day, on promoting supply chain resilience. They invited industry leaders, experts came in, told their stories, weighed in on how American business can, well, do what we've been talking about for a long time. Divest from China, ensure that they can still exist and grow and all of that. Basically, in short, how we can fix all the bad policy of the last 20 years and undo all the damage corporate America's greed imposed on them and, well, ultimately, us as workers and consumers. And one of those folks who got to go in and preach the good word, one of those experts, our very own Scott Paul. Scott's the president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing and my chief wonk on all that is made in America and trade in America. Scott, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick, it's great to be with you.
So 8 hours, 2 days in a row, that seems like a lot.
It is a lot. And I want to take a step back because I think this is super important to point out. In the past, the U.S. trade representative, and I'm talking about Democratic and Republican administrations going back decades, was all about, you know, giving the corporate interests their say and promoting free trade and really sidelining trade enforcement or issues like this, okay? And so obviously there were some more trade enforcement measures in the last administration, but I will say the Biden administration has really picked it up when it comes to reaching out to a broader set of people about how trade policy impacts America, which it does, because you know this, I know this, that you see it in every town, but USTR never got that before. Now they do. And, you know, about 2 years ago, they had an inquiry on how trade agreements impact vulnerable communities in the United States, which was about, again, 20 or 30 years overdue, but thank God they did it. And they published some findings out of that that were very valuable. So now we come and they're like, you know, we want to see how our trade and investment policies are aligning with this new goal to have supply chain resilience in the United States. And what is supply chain resilience? Well, it's making sure that we don't have shortages, that we don't have price spikes, that we aren't subject to undue political risk if things are coming in overseas and suddenly some country wants to shut them off. And that for particularly for vital and strategic items, and believe me, there's a lot of these, that we have the capacity to make a lot of this at home so that we're not going to see some economic turmoil or health crisis or widespread unemployment because we simply can't make, you know, product A or product B here in the United States. So I would say it's just super awesome that the Trade Ambassador's Office has realized this is a problem and is reaching out to experts. And it was great. I was on the first panel, and I don't know that I've ever been on a trade panel at an official government hearing before where everybody is essentially agreeing with each other. And so, because usually I'm the skunk at the garden party, right? I'm the one saying, you know, this is, or the turd in the punch bowl, if you will, right? I'm the one who ruins everything. But this was like a choir singing in harmony together about the need to make changes. And it was really great to be able to deliver some of that.
So how do you sit there and not look around the room and go, hey, about time?
Well, I did a little dog and pony show. I held up the reports, and I know you know these because you hold them up all the time, that General John Adams did for us more than a decade ago about supply chain vulnerabilities in our national defense. I that's one of your favorites, I remember. And then we also had one that former governor and Secretary of Homeland Security Tom Ridge did for us on supply chains and how we're vulnerable. And we did these more than a decade ago. And basically everything that was articulated in those reports turned out to be true, right? And we never, you know, no one ever followed up on the recommendations. And, you know, everybody, obviously we all lived through COVID. We all lived through the supply chain disruptions. We saw how that was. And so I did a little bit of the told you so, but most of it was spent on, well, what do we do to make sure that we're insulated as much as possible against these vulnerabilities the next time? Because there will be a next time. The only question is when, where, how, right? But there will definitely be a next time to all of this, right?
Yeah, and how prepared are we going to be for pandemic 2.0 or whatever? Because look, they're predicting another one at some point. And a lot of people are saying, look, we dodged a major bullet. It wasn't as bad as it could have been given some of the history that we've seen on this planet. So for me, this is great to have this conversation. So the question that comes is, you know, which side are we looking at this as? Is this, we're pursuing this for business interests to make sure that they're well healed and taken care of, or for we the people, we the working people, we the citizens, we the consumers, you know, which side is that focus? And I know you probably can't answer that, but for me, that's something to be paying attention to.
Yeah, well, that's exactly right. And there is this like larger debate in economics that, you know, is consumer efficiency the most important metric that we can judge a policy by? Is that really the most important thing? As we've seen all these other crises emerge around us, and, you know, to get that rock bottom price there, is that actually the most important thing? And this isn't an argument about raising prices necessarily, but it is about reprioritization and understanding that it is worth the sweat equity that we're putting into building more supply chain capabilities in the United States. And it will cost a little bit up front, but over the longer run, we're all going to be better off for this, number one. And then number two, from a security perspective, you know, like consumer efficiency and economic and national security don't always align. In fact, they rarely align. And so if we are truly concerned about the broader public welfare, the focus should be on you know, economic and national security. And that means that trade and investment agreements need to be structured differently, that we can't be afraid to use tariffs. We can't be afraid to use investment restrictions. We shouldn't be afraid to use industrial policies to promote incubating industries in the United States. We should, by all means, utilize our public procurement because it's so large to have these Buy American policies that create market, shape markets here, that all of these should be a part of it rather than just this need to get the tariff rate down from 2.5% to 0%, which accomplishes very little for Americans, but increases the margins for multinational corporations who like to do that sort of arbitrage and make even more money for their already well-off shareholders.
Yeah. No, for me, it comes down ultimately to the question I've asked, you know, a lot over the last 19 years of doing this is, what good is an economy? What's it for? What is an economy for? Is it for making a handful of rich people even richer? Or is it for, you know, like my grandparents were able to do, build the most prosperous working class in history so one income can support a family and do it well? Where you have domestic production for domestic consumption and that you have your national security needs met. So for me, the question of what good is, what's an economy for, this is part of that, I think.
It absolutely is. And it takes the more holistic and proper view of it rather than just looking at the lowest cost possible. And I'm not going to suggest that, you know, prices aren't important. They are. You know, and we have to make sure that wages are growing and that they're growing faster than prices are. But if we totally depend on that free market model or that free trade in you know, in air quotes model, then the problem is that we're gonna those corporations are gonna find the lowest cost possible to make that product, and it's going to be a whack-a-mole attempt to try to make sure that all of this is done fairly, right? Because it's always, they're going to find a labor market that they can exploit more, a country in which they can pollute more, and find other ways to shift the costs over to workers, to broader concerns, so that they can pocket the margin for themselves. And so, as I argued in this in this testimony, that means changing free trade agreements, that making sure what we have, what are called rules of origin, that mean that if you really want the benefits of being a trading relationship in the United States, you gotta make sure that those products are made in our markets respectively and not, say, in China, for instance, which has been an ongoing problem.
You know, I read one of your articles where you talk about the three overarching themes of your testimony. You know, one of them being, you know, trade policy and investment that work to enhance rather than undermine domestic incentives for manufacturing, meaning that, you know, we want to make sure that we're supplying, you know, what we need for the entire investment and not just pieces of it. And also you said prioritizing expansion at all stages of manufacturing, which is something that China did very well. And you have to give them credit. They knew what they were doing. They saw the elephant, if you will, while we were just looking at its behind.
Yeah. Yeah. And a great example of this is all the speed bumps that we've seen in trying to establish an EV market in the United States. So it is, you know, and we've seen a lot of announcements of companies that are building or going to build EVs in the United States. But you think about all the parts that go into that, right? And the problem right now is that for some of the mineral processing, for some of the battery technology, sometimes 90% or more of that is concentrated in China right now. And so it has to be, all of these efforts have to look at the entire supply chain in the United States. So you're not just getting that big factory announcement like, oh, you know, Ford is opening a plant here, or even Honda is opening a plant in the United States to build EVs, right? It's got to be, we're also bringing the supply chain to the United States because honestly, there'll be more jobs there. And that's where we can really get, you know, snookered in the security stuff. And we already have seen this, where China has placed export controls on some of the minerals that we need to make, you know, with a certain kind of this battery technology, with the graphite in lithium ion batteries. And so we're kind of hostage to that. And we don't want to put ourselves in that position in the future. And so that means, like, this, again, this holistic kind of all the parts in the product approach to supply chain resiliency.
What do you say to the argument of which I kind of think if they hold all of these minerals and all of the cards in this, why wouldn't we be pursuing something else? Is there nothing else? Is there nothing that we could undo so we are not always dependent on them in some vein? Because this is one of those things that's curious to me. We're moving in this direction that, we're going to go to electric vehicles at some point in my life, but still be dependent on really an adversary.
Yeah. So that is a great question. And that's the question. I think the answer is, well, we shouldn't. I don't think the answer is, well, we shouldn't do it, which is what some are saying, right? Well, let's just keep on with the internal combustion engine. Not understanding that we still get a ton of parts from China and other countries for the internal combustion engines too. But with respect to batteries, yeah, we're way behind. And the answer is going to be a couplefold. It is going to be these efforts to make sure that we're able to mine some of these minerals in the United States, number one. Where we don't have them in abundance, we need to make sure, number two, that we have agreements with other countries where we can get these mined materials and also processing, who are our allies, in all of this. And then the third aspect of this is that we need to look at other technologies like the sodium technology, which is emerging, where you don't necessarily need some of these other types of materials that aren't necessarily abundant in the United States. So it's going to take an effort like that. And I do think that, the market signals that have to be sent through the incentives that are provided in the Inflation Reduction Act have to move that battery scale way up in a hurry so that companies know that if they want any of these benefits, the stuff has to sooner rather than later be mined, processed, manufactured in the United States or with a trusted ally if we don't yet have that capacity, rather than leaning on China, which is the cheap, lazy, easy thing to do, because that's where virtually the entire ecosystem is right now.
Yeah, I mean, I look at this and, I'm the last line of questioning I wanted to ask you on, because, I was thinking about this last night as I was, reading through some of the stories on these hearings, and my mind kept going back to, when was the last time we as a country came together in a major call for action? I think back to, JFK, and we're going to go to the space race. We're going to go to the moon. This last mobilization of doing something really great. And I see this as potentially, and I've said this in other places before, this is that moment where maybe we're able to unite around the idea that, we should be producing the next generation of technology for ourselves and for the future. And doing it in a way that, we benefit from it.
I think that's absolutely right, because when you think about the, on the one hand, some of our companies have been quite successful in getting their ideas out there, like Apple, right? But the problem is that instead of making the stuff here, they're making it in Asia. And as a result, by the way, we don't have a single mass market smartphone that's made in the United States. And it's made living in Silicon Valley great if you're a millionaire, but it sucks for everybody else who can't afford it, basically. And so that shouldn't be the model. It should be, as you said, that we're going to invent the next amazing breakthrough here, and we're also going to make it here. And it's going to make us all better off that way. And the world is going to love us, not only for our culture and for introducing smartphones into the marketplace, but this other XYZ idea that is going to make the world a better place, and we're providing it. And so I do think we need that mentality. Industrial policy is a part of it, but having the capability, like, you have to be able to do it here. If you were to try to set up even a company to make a laptop in the United States right now, you would be hard pressed to find, the ecosystem that can get you all the parts coming from the United States. Yeah. Not to mention the crazy stuff we haven't even imagined yet. So we have a long way to go, but this is one step on that journey.
No, you're spot on. And I love the fact that you got to be there in the first part of it. You got there to maybe, I'm not going to say rub their nose in it, but, you know, you say, thank goodness you're here now and let's move forward. But, Scott, as always, great stuff. I look forward to having you back again real soon.
Appreciate it, Rick. Thanks so much.
As always, our good friend Scott Paul. I want to hear your thoughts. Should we be bringing I know it's a dumb question, but should we be bringing it back? Should we be, as I said about Trump, you know, got my family to believe that Brook Park Avenue was coming back? All those jobs, all of that input? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1907. That was the day known in the San Francisco labor movement as Bloody Tuesday. In the early 20th century, San Francisco was a city with a strong union movement. In early May, the Carmen's Union called a strike against United Railroads, the company that ran the city's transit system. 1,500 carmen walked off the job, demanding an 8-hour workday and a $3 per day wage. The strike began on a Sunday. The city's transit lines stood silent. The next day, tensions began to mount. The company put up barbed wire around the car barns. Strikers believed this was in preparation to get the streetcars back up and running. Strikers and supporters gathered around the car barns. The day passed with nothing happening. But the next morning, as picketers gathered, six cars rolled out of the barns. Hired guns rode with the scab drivers. Angry picketers attempted to stop the streetcars, bombarding them with bricks and stones. Gunfire erupted between the armed company guards and the picketers. Two picketers were killed in the hail of gunfire. Many more were injured. But this bloody day was not the end of the injuries. It's estimated that 24 people were killed in accidents while scab drivers operated the streetcars. Strikes by public transportation workers were often some of the most contested work actions to take place in big cities. These workers had the ability to impact work sites far beyond their own, since they transported laborers to work. The magnitude of a transportation strike would ripple throughout a city, and these strikes were often met with fierce resistance. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So mark your calendars, Saturday, May 11th. That is Stamp Out Hunger Day, as letter carriers across the country will be picking up bags of non-perishable items to help people who are a little less fortunate. They've been doing this for more than 30 years. I saw statistics that they've collected somewhere around 2 billion pounds of food to help those in need, and it's an incredible thing that the folks at NALC do, that the letter carriers do to help our communities. Because understand, letter carriers, they're intimately intertwined into our communities. 6 days a week, they're at our front door. They're walking through our neighborhoods. They're talking to our friends and neighbors. They're an incredible and important part of our community. And this just being one more thing. So all in favor of stamping out hunger. So on May 11th, make sure you've got your bag of non-perishable food items out for the letter carrier to pick out. Let's make his day difficult. Let's make him lift a lot of bags and carry stuff out. Now you go, why May? Well, evidently, according to the research that they did years ago, this is kind of that period between Thanksgiving and Christmas where people are a little more generous. It's where those donations are starting to run out. And this is going to help catapult people through the summer, help get up back to Thanksgiving and keep it going. So again, mark the calendar, Saturday, May 11th, help the folks at NALC stamp out hunger. Also, it's National Safety Stand Down Week. Our friends in the building trades focus their attention on preventing falls in the workplace in construction. You do know that falls are the leading cause of death in the construction industry. And look, prioritizing safety, we can prevent some of this. If you want more information on the National Safety Stand Down Week, OSHA.org, the website, if you want to take a look at the work that they're doing, and some of the informative videos and toolkits and all of the things there as well. Also, happy National Nurses Week. Thank you for all you do. We are grateful for your passion and sacrifice. You make a difference every day. And every one of us have a story about how an incredible nurse made, you know, some of our most dark moments better. So thank you for your sacrifice and your passion. You do make a difference every day and truly, truly are essential. Truly are our frontline heroes. So thank you for that. Lots of opportunities to engage. And again, mark the calendars. Mark the calendars because it's important stuff. Now, I do want to finish up real quick with what we talked about with Scott Paul, because I think it's important to understand what he was talking about in the sense of we need smart policy leaders. We need working class policy leaders. We need people who understand, you know, the supply chains more than just making profit and having mass efficiencies to make more profit. It's about ensuring that we're secure. And I think coming out of the pandemic, a lot of us figured it out real quick when the store shelves were empty for the first time. And I know everyone said, you know, we were better off 4 years ago. No, we weren't. 4 years ago, shelves were empty. It showed how broken our supply chains are. Also shows just how allowing mass consolidation and monopoly to spring up, how that's bad for us as well. So this is an opportunity, and I love the fact that they're holding hearings, and I know there are more hearings coming by the U.S. Trade Office. This is an opportunity to start talking about what an economy is for. And I know I've had this conversation before, and people have said, "Well, it's all of the corporate jargon, eliminate inefficiencies, and cut down on redundancy and synergy, and all of those corporate buzzwords that mean less people, more profit." So there's an opportunity here now with an administration, and this administration I think is moving us in the right direction. The pieces are in place to take us in a direction to where maybe we turn the ship around. You know, I think about my MAGA friends and my family as well, who when they heard Trump's rhetoric around trade, around manufacturing, they were drawn to it. And I agreed with him. I agreed with him on reshoring manufacturing and the need for communities to have that employment and the security of building stuff. He just didn't do anything about it. In fact, in most cases, made it worse. Biden's actually got an industrial policy that is moving us in a good direction. The idea of seeing the manufacturing elephant, if you will. And I always use the example of Brook Park Avenue, where I grew up around. This idea that you had, Ford and Chevy at one end, on each end of the avenue. And all along, you had all of the feeder plants, all the metal stamping plants, all of the little factories that fed into that. The supply chain, it was all right there. It was all holistic. And it was, hey, I need some more. You could ramp up production. We've offshored all of that capacity. And the reality is we've got to figure out how to get back there and in a way that isn't going to cause massive amounts of pain. But I'll tell you this. There needs to be a call to action, a national call to action, a national call to civic responsibility, to patriotism, if you will, to ensure that we leave our kids something worth inheriting, that there is something here when we're all gone. That's just my thought. I want to hear yours. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Something I said made you think, got under your skin, made you mad, made you happy, made you sad. By all means, I want to hear it. rick@thericksmithshow.com. You can also check out our podcast if you miss any portion of the program, or if you get your favorite podcast, you'll find ours. Also, the video component over at freespeech.org. As always, appreciate you being here. Thanks so much. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. At rick@therickSmithShow.com. Until next time.
You're listening to Lake Air 1260 AM WLAK Amory and 107.5 FM W298 DK Amory. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.